manufacture for us, because what we say is in them is in them, because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine, shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
At the races with Steve Wick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Wick.
We're back, and just in time, too. Managed to get a cup of coffee and managed to make a quick run down the hall. Pat McKenna is next, Kay. Let me make sure you do you have you got Pat's number, just in case. All right, let me make sure. It's funny, Pat said, "How's 10:30?" And I didn't at the time. I didn't think it would be 10:30, but it is second half, and we're also going to check in with Bill Gallo and with Joe Clancy. All right. yeah, Jenny Reese is asking me, when's Tom Rapp's going to be on? I said, well, Jenny, he's already been on. Going to pull up and see if at the same time, too, as we wait for Pat, let's see if Andy has got the opening day scratches out. And the answer is no, not yet. All right, 10:30. So I just was curious. I've got the PPs in front of me, and when it comes to the action in New York on Saturday, got some international participation, which was anticipated, and we also have to look when we get a minute. I'm glad that KK mentioned Joe Talamo being out of town on Saturday. He is at Woodbine for Paulo Lobo, whose name, of course, came up earlier. And he's riding Ivar in the Woodbine Mile. That's why he's not here. The tack has shifted, of course, in New York, straight over to Aqueduct and right from Saratoga to the Big A. And it's got a lot of people talking about historic portions of New York racing history. Bob Ehalt wrote a piece that I saw harkening back to the 60s when Belmont underwent its big renovation. And then, of course, the same thing happened in the other direction when Aqueduct was refreshed. And it's that time again as a new era. This is really just the opening stages of what is going to be the long-term downstate racing landscape. Pat McKenna, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I'm actually looking out at the track now, and I'm seeing our facility staff installing jumps on the inner turf here at Aqueduct for the first time in many, many decades. So we're excited to be back here at Aqueduct, especially because it means that things are moving forward at Belmont Park, which is hugely positive news for the future of downstate racing here in New York.
What's the sense? What's the feeling? I really haven't talked to anybody with being on this trip. I really haven't spoken to anybody that, and of course today's the first day, but, I suppose that, anybody that campaigns their horses in New York regularly, it's not that unusual the last couple of years to be trained at Belmont in the morning, go home, freshen up and then make the drive over to Aqueduct. It's not like it's a completely foreign, set of practices.
No, it's a good point. I mean, we Aqueduct was closed to training and stabling 2019, I believe it was. So it's been quite a few years since Aqueduct was actively utilized for training or stabling in any major way. So you're right. We certainly appreciate the patience of horsemen racing participants because we recognize that it's a little bit of a longer stay, and obviously to be shipping in and out every day over the course of the next 6 months can be a little bit trying. But, you know, ultimately, this is hugely positive news, as I mentioned earlier, because the future of racing, we believe the future of racing downstate is dependent upon consolidating to one facility. That facility will be Belmont Park. We love Aqueduct. I think there is a misconception that that somehow Aqueduct is our redheaded stepchild. That's not the case at all. You know, each of these facilities has their own unique character. Aqueduct is New York City's racetrack. It is an urban racetrack. It is far different than Belmont or obviously Saratoga. That doesn't mean that we don't appreciate the history and the traditions of Aqueduct, but the sport is evolving. And that's why we're so confident that our ability to conduct world-class racing hinges on consolidating to a facility at Belmont Park that will be capable of hosting year-round racing in a modern facility, in a grandstand that's completely reimagined from what exists now and what was built for a completely different era. And that's the reality. So as we sit here opening Belmont at the Big A, as we're referring to it, what this portends is big changes for the landscape of racing in New York, but really positive changes. And we're optimistic that we'll be able to secure the financing to, again, construct a new building in the place of a, you know, 1.5 million square foot facility that exists now. So something that is right-sized, as you'll hear, something that will feel intimate and exciting day-to-day, but will also allow us to provide us the flexibility to scale up on a Belmont Day, on a Stars and Stripes, on Father's Day, those days which still draw huge crowds. So these are good things. We're thrilled to be here at Aqueduct, and we're really looking forward to some fantastic racing here. The turf courses look impeccable, as you can imagine. They've essentially been untouched since last April. So great turf racing here throughout September, October, into November, and it should be exciting.
Pat, a couple of things on that front. There's been all kinds of speculation and suggestions about contingencies and how how particularly the Belmont racing will unfold in the coming year, couple of years. Is it even worth trying to to anticipate? There's people who said, there's going to be a Belmont at Saratoga, and
sure. I'll stop you right there.
Address all Saratoga, of that stuff, if you would.
Yeah, no, of course. First of all, we're on, if not ahead of schedule, with progress on excavating and then constructing a tunnel on the north side of Belmont. Once that's complete, we'll put that area of the track back together. We'll conduct the 2023 Belmont Park Spring Summer Meet in its entirety on schedule at Belmont Park as it was designed to be held, along the same schedule that we had this year. We will open up Saratoga. I don't have the calendar in front of me, but 40-day, 5-day race weeks, that's been a really successful formula for Saratoga. There's no conversation about extending that meet on either end of it, certainly not on the front end of it. Doesn't make any sense to do it on the back end of it either. So, yeah, I mean, listen, are we going to be running at Belmont Park next fall? Unlikely. You know, this kind of schedule is very likely to play out in the fall of 2023 back here at Aqueduct. But in terms of Saratoga, since we reworked the schedule to extend it by a week while maintaining 40 days and 5 day race weeks, it's been remarkably successful. Every single metric that's important to the business has seen explosive growth. Three record wagering years in the last four seasons, attendance north of 1 million every year, excluding 2020 when we were closed because of the pandemic. So it's the ultimate, why mess with a good thing? Saratoga, it's a fantastic formula. And no, we are not discussing any changes to what is the most successful race meet in the country, if not the world.
Good. I wanted to have you just at least, you know, quell some of the speculation that seemed to, you know, be emanating at the end of the meet.
And it's always a topic of discussion towards the, as we close up Saratoga. In a lot of ways, that it shows you just how much interest there is in all things Saratoga, that it comes up year after year after year. But we've been clear that, you know, this 5 day, two dark days, Wednesday through Sunday, you know, that the folks who are expert at this looked at those numbers, you know, in a really in-depth way before we settled on Wednesday through Sunday, as opposed to, you know, Thursday through Monday. And the reality is Wednesday through Sunday is ideal. You know, we even heard from our friends in the business community, from hotels this year, that unlike previous years, they were seeing record occupancy on Mondays and Tuesdays. So, you know, Saratoga has never been more popular. The popularity of the summer meet is clearly at an all-time high. So it's, you know, it's a privilege to be able to operate a venue, to be stewards of the country's most historic sporting venue, and to see year after year that it only grows in popularity. I think the energy around that facility this summer was certainly like nothing I've ever experienced day to day, whether it was early on a Wednesday afternoon, late in the day on a Saturday. It was an incredible summer.
Pat, I don't even know if this is worth exploring either, but I saw the chatter about the Belmonted Aqueduct designation being a confusing element and potentially unnecessary aspect. Is there any rationale that needs to be discussed about the BAQ lettering for this meet?
No, Steve, I actually didn't see any of that chatter. But no, I mean, the code is, I think it's pretty straightforward, Belmonted Aqueduct. I don't, no, but I try to stay abreast of all those kinds of developments and chatter, but no, I hadn't, I'm frankly not aware of it.
The one that I remember the most similar to it, was Oak Tree. When Oak Tree, there was that point where they moved the designation of the Oak Tree meet, and it became OSA, Oak Tree at Santa Anita. That's the most akin to this. I just saw some discussion, and I made the point this morning that people saying, oh, well, they're trying to make it the way, you know, the way Gulfstream did Gulfstream Park West, and how much more handle they got for the Calder signal, essentially, than if it was called Calder. And that isn't necessarily the case. This is a very different scenario. The wagering menu, when Aqueduct runs in the winter, is a different menu than right now. It's not, horse players are going to gravitate to where the racing is, as opposed to, you know, just simply making a decision based on, you know, on what the, you know, on what the track code is.
Yeah, I would hope so. But anyway, slice it, I think what we've seen here at Aqueduct in the fall meet, that's the best racing you know, anywhere in the country. Players gravitate to the product that we're able to put out in New York. And, you know, we're confident that this meet will be a tremendous success.
Certainly based on the early, you know, the early action here, it looks like Belmont. It's the Belmont book, and it just so happens that it's going to run at Aqueduct. There's not, you know, there isn't a lot of mental gymnastics that are really needed for this, I don't think.
No. some new F&B offerings. We're going to be doing NFL Sundays at Long Shots. So for $25, fans in person can come, and there will be complimentary food, and we'll have all the NFL games on, along with the standard simulcast signals and obviously live racing right here at the Big A. So, you know, if you haven't, if listeners are in the area, want to take a short subway ride out from wherever you may be, maybe you haven't visited Aqueduct in some time, come on out and see us. You know, when the weather is, you know, hopefully the weather will be great, and it's a really nice spot to sit in the grandstand and enjoy some racing.
Well, looking forward to it. We got a debuting 2-year-old at some point this fall, and Countess Constance, and Shirzando's going to come back here in the next, probably in the next 30, 45 days. So I'm looking forward to it, and it'll be unique. I'd be happy to. I'm funny. I don't really care where the wind photo emanates. It doesn't.
That's right. I see some jumps. I see some steeplechase riders out there inspecting the jumps, inspecting the turf, which again looks beautiful. One quick reminder: every day of Belmont at the Big A can be found on America's Day at the Races on the networks of Fox Sports. It's a mix between FS1, FS2. Check out NYRA.com. There's a channel finder. There's a schedule daily, but America's Day at the Races is back today and every day of this fall season.
Pat McKenna, everybody, PC McKenna on your Twitter, and we are getting ready to make the jump, and we're going to talk to Joe Clancy and to Bill Gallo. The William Entiman kicks things off for the season, and the Grade 1 Lonesome Glory, a unique start to the Aqueduct winter and spring and fall that starts today, 1 o'clock, kicks things off. Pat, I appreciate it, and I'll see you probably see you sometime in October.
Appreciate the time, Steve. Look forward to seeing you here at the Big A.
Absolutely. Pat McKenna, everybody, and in addition to the kickoff today with the two jump stakes, we've also, of course, looking forward to the Jockey Club Derby and Oaks on Saturday. We'll talk to Dave tomorrow, to Dave Grenick, and dig into it with him. Speaking of Dave's, Dave Hill is going to join us at the top of the hour, and I think, Case, you know, right now, just got enough of a window. Let's try Clancy and Gallo. They've been stuck essentially on the Belt Parkway, it seems, most of the morning, from what Joe is telling me. So let's see if there may be, by now they might be in the parking lot of the Big A. We'll see. All right, and they come up, and you'll see Joe, I'm sure, on Talking Horses too, right? He'll be doing Talking Horses for the Entiman and the Lonesome Glory. It is amazing, you know, to think to have the two biggest stars of the jump set, the Mean Queen 1-2 in the Entiman, as Kerry Brion clearly, you know, dealing with, you know, some issues with the Mean Queen and getting her into a, you know, a regular program, and she'll basically is angling toward Far Hills and a confrontation there with Snap Decision, and then Snap Decision 2-5 in the Lonesome Glory. So I don't know what the double what the Mean Queen snap decision double should look at the will pays. They're probably up already. But not too often you see this, to have them in back-to-back races like this. I mean, there's a couple of decent, they both have got some horses to face off against. It's not, the thing is that the way in which Snap Decision handled that group in the Jonathan Shepherd, I mean, just with utter disdain. But there's also, whenever there's North American, first-time North America types, and some new faces. There's a horse that Kerry Brion introduces in the Entenmann against the Mean Queen called Going Country, a Yates 6-year-old gelding That's not the one. That the Yates was here. Who did I see? There it is. The Kerry Brion. There we go. Ask Paddington. Comes an 8-year-old. That's the first time North America and in the Lonesome Glory. So we got a new face that we're going to find out about. And you got second time North America for Leslie Young, Song for Someone as well. And Amshell returns in the Lonesome Glory for Cyril Murphy and Mr. Naylor, last seen third in the Iroquois behind Snap Decision. So it's not automatic. All right, Joe needs a couple of minutes, says Casey. All right, then we will wait. And I'll mention, as part of the follow-up to Pat's visit, 33 stakes, $6 million. Between this and the fall meet. And this is the fall portion that'll kick off in November. So after they run the Belmont portion, let me see what else we can tell you about before Joe joins us. He must be just walking in. I'll tell you that from yesterday that. I had hoped we would get to. We ended up, there just was too much going on yesterday, and we did lose the first, whatever it was, 25 minutes. Yesterday at Indy, let me slip in those two stakes and what transpired there. Max Express, you had an upset in the Empire stake, the mile and a 16th for the Indiana Breds and Indiana Sired. Mike Lauer and Penny and partners. This is a homebred of theirs, an Unbridled Express gelding, 6-year-old, beat the two short price favorites, Mr. Chaos, who was 3-2, and Star Spangled Express, who was even money, and Giovanni Franco aboard for Lauer, and paid a nice $13.20 in here in this Empire. And then in the Heartland for the Phillies and Mares, second choice, Fireball Baby. And there is no stopping. There's just no stopping Phil Bauer. Phil Bauer is a juggernaut himself. It's been a big week of juggernaut performance. Yeah. Bauer, who had just a spectacular Saratoga, an amazing Saratoga, actually. Fireball Baby, the 6-year-old mare by Noble's Promise. Yeah. Noble's Promise, McPeak, if you'll recall. Led the Derby, right? Ran a huge race in the Derby. And my man, Willie Martinez, a Noble's Promise regular rider, right? There was also a futurity yesterday at Indy. And Randy Smith and Deborah Smith with the DuPont Philly, the Sorrel, our Louisiana girl. Paid nice, was 13-2. Paid $13. There you go. And they had a nice sequence yesterday at Indy, if you didn't see it. And I mentioned Paulo Lobo, Paulo with a double for Larry Best. And Larry, I don't know if Larry Best actually bet on his horses, maybe, to help him pay for the million-dollar hip he bought yesterday. But Fortin Hill and Gunton Row, back-to-back in the fifth and sixth races yesterday at Indy. And Alex Achard in both cases. And they were well, Fortin Hill was favored, the heavy favorite. But Gunton Row was not, actually, and beat the 1-2 favorite. Gunton Row was almost 7-2, paid 860. So Paulo Lobo just does a great, great job. And the pick five yesterday, $546. And the tough horse was Max Express, pretty much. That was in the Empire. So as we've said, between Canterbury, and of course Canterbury's wrapping up Saturday, but between Canterbury and Colonial wrapping up, these pick fives at the low takeout rate just have been really productive. Joe is joining us. And
hey, how are you?
Joe Clancy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. You guys had yourself some adventurous trip.
Yes, yeah, and a little navigational. Aqueduct hasn't moved, but you know maybe they moved some exits since the last time.
I love it.
But we got here. We made it. It looks beautiful. I'm breaking my Aqueduct maiden. I've never been.
Are you kidding?
I know. I literally remember putting horses on the van at Delaware Park to go to Aqueduct when I went somewhere else. So that's as close as I got.
Oh, that's wild that you've never been to Big Ed.
I know.
Well, then you're going to be the poster boy for the post trip evaluation. Exactly. It's exactly right. It's a big, beautiful racetrack in a city, and that's the bottom line. It's a city racetrack, the way Hawthorne is, the way Hollywood was. I mean, it's a city track.
Yeah, for sure. I'm literally in the parking lot, so I haven't seen much other than that. You know.
Well, you're gonna wait till you get inside. You're gonna enjoy it.
I don't think you can't get in yet. It appears to be locked.
Oh, so 11, maybe the gates open at 11?
Apparently. Again, I don't know. Half you are not in line at JFK Airport, which is where we thought we were headed briefly, but we're good now.
That's funny. Joe, let's talk about this unique situation and the fact that they're, for everybody's intent and purposes, I mean, they haven't seen a jump race at the Big A in close to a half a century. It certainly hosted its share, and that racing association, whether it was at Sheepshead Bay, and then later at Aqueduct, and the Jamaica Association, tons of steeplechase. Certainly at Sheepshead Bay and at Coney Island, I mean, that was the most important racing. It's why the roller coaster is known as the Steeplechase Park. I mean, it's all tied in historically. So in a lot of ways, this is a historic day.
Yeah, to me that part's pretty cool, and I got into it a little bit trying to look up some of the history or story on our website, and especially during the early days. Yeah, it was. I mean, there was a jump race on the opening day at Belmont Park in 1905. It was part of it. There was a steeplechase course that they called it Belmont Terminal, which was across the road from Belmont Park that had full steeplechase meetings and things. And Aqueduct obviously had its share. There was a guy who, Regan McKinney, in 1930 rode out at Westbury in a race and then got in a car and got to Aqueduct in time to ride a race there too on the same day. So, that part's fascinating and to get into the history. Obviously during the 60s when Belmont, Pat touched on a little bit, you did, on the construction that was going on at Belmont, there were, some major, major races here in the 60s, and some of the all-time greats ran here, the Grand National and the Glossmy and the the Brook and the Meadowbrook and some of those races were held here, you know, when Belmont was being worked on. And, I think it's, I mean, it, obviously this is a little bit of a quirk and for the reason it happened, but I think it's, you know, it does make you think of that a little bit. And, on the modern side, you know, it should be a fantastic fresh turf course to run on. And, you know, it works. I mean, I think it's a great idea. And it is literally a mirror image of Saratoga in terms of that 7 furlong inner turf course. It really shouldn't be much different than that. Very different from Belmont in terms of race setup or race configuration, but very similar to Saratoga.
Explain that, Joe, and how that comes into play in particular, because as it happens, the Lonesome Glory ends up being typically an outlier for that reason, and this does feel like a pair of stakes that are just a coda to Saratoga, and very often people have made that, you know, comparison that the Saratoga's configurations are much more aqueduct friendly than Belmont friendly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and talking to the jockeys a little bit, they always talk about how positioning matters at Saratoga, where maybe it's not quite so important at Belmont, where you've got more wide open spaces and things to work with. Where, you know, I always hear from the jump jockeys who say they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to lose position with a lap to go at Saratoga, and because of the tight nature of the course, and I would assume that's going to be the same thing today.
Well, let's talk about what we end up looking at, and these two runnings. I mean, to have the Mean Queen and Snap Decision, Joe, prepping extensive, you know, for all intents and purposes for Far Hills and for the Grand National, but to have them run back to back, I mean, this is also a unique circumstance, and it does feel like Kerry Breon has been playing a little catch up and has had a much more difficult season with the Mean Queen this year than last year.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, she was, you know, on target to try to run at the Iroquois and obviously had a little setback. And, you know, I think she decided not to push and try to make Saratoga, you know, knowing that especially the Far Hills race at $250,000 purse, you know, was the ultimate target. And she's got that novice condition. You know, she didn't break her maiden until April of last year. So she's eligible for the easier spot. You know, horse training 101, you're supposed to take the easier spot with your horse. I think especially coming off like she is, a layoff of, you know, 11 months, you know, the easier spot is the place to be. I think, you know, we and even she would probably, as a fan, want to see her in the same race as Snap Decision, but you got to do, you know, I think it's the right move. It's the right move for your horse as much as we want to see them run together, and I guess we'll just have to wait a month for that to happen.
Who else are we looking at and talking about? You know, I do see that David, looking at the sentiment field, I do see that David made Howie Abud, one of Kerry's other two runners, 4-1, and actually even the third choice, Kerry Breon, going country with Mullins. Talk about the rest of this field.
Yeah, I mean, those two certainly make sense, and I know Kerry thinks Howie Abud is a nice horse coming along. He obviously fits much more of the, you know, novice type definition, where he didn't break his maiden until this year, you know. But I'm not sure if she thinks he's at the level of the Mean Queen yet, for sure. Going country drops out of the, you know, Shepherd, the tougher race at Saratoga here, which I think that just like any flat race, the horse kind of getting a little class relief has to be considered. I just like the horse too much, but I think Todd Wyatt's horse, State of Affairs, live again, you know, and he's 20-1 on the morning line. I don't think he'll get that, but I think he's live. I like his setup where, like, a horse like Proven Innocent is coming back kind of quick for me, where State of Affairs was running at Saratoga, and he comes in off a nice sort of setup, you know, and I don't know. Yeah, I don't think any of them are of the caliber of the Mean Queen, but if you're going to, if you're trying to bet the race and you're, you know, you think you want to try to beat a really, really heavy favorite who has some questions, the 11-month layoff first time Parker Hendricks has ridden her in a race. I don't think anybody's, she's not a mystery anymore. Last year there was some mystery about her, you know. Clearly the horse to beat. And that probably changes the way some people ride against her. So I think, you know, a horse like State of Affair to me is live at a price. One horse comes out, Bandua is a scratch, which kind of narrows the field down a little bit, which is tough. But, you know, again, she's going to be a really short price. Is she vulnerable? If she's ever vulnerable, I guess it's, you know, I don't know. I still don't think she's that vulnerable.
Joe Clancy with us as we look at the start to the Belmont Aqueduct fall season and the unique circumstance that brings jump racing back to the Big A. Lonesome Glory, the grade one, and the next grade one, essentially, before we get to Far Hills next month, and Snap Decision 2-5 with Grant Waters for Jack Fisher. And he could not have been more impressive than he was winning the Jonathan Shepherd.
No, and that was, to me, as good a performance as, you know, we've seen in American jump racing in a long time. I mean, we've seen good races, but to see him do that the way he did it, carrying 164 pounds, giving weight away to horses, and just, there was never any doubt, and he just, you know, he attacked his fences. I mean, there's photos. The photos don't really do it justice. The video, if you can slow it down, of what, the way he was leaping the fences at Saratoga, where his front feet are up above the black plastic, and he's just going for it, you know. And it puts other horses on the defensive right away. He's never really been a front runner. I think that race nobody else really wanted to go, and Graham Waters was like, oh, I'm not going to sit back here and behind horses and make him unhappy. Let's go, you know, and he just buried them. You know, Kenny picks up weight, gives more away. There's a couple new shooters in there maybe that make you pause a little, but, you know, he's going to be very tough to handle if he runs anywhere near that race back from the Shepherd. And, you know, to me, he's not in a hurry. I think it's a good setup. It's been, you know, it's been 4 weeks. It's a, you know, it's good. It's the perfect kind of race for him to come back in. And we saw how good he was. I mean, he was third in that race at Colonial on the flat to Red Knight, who comes back and wins the race at Kentucky Downs. You know, so
that's right. That's right.
Got tears, you know, and you know, sort of has it all going for him. There's, you know, Steve Asmussen likes to tell us there's a reason they let you bet on these things. You know, the results are so easy to figure out, they'll let you bet. You know, so he has to go do it again. But I think, you know, he doesn't necessarily have a horse like the Mean Queen to try to, you know, really look in the eye like he did twice last year. And it'll be really tough to handle.
Joe.
And he's run at Aqueduct before. Don't forget, he knows the place. He ran here three times on the dirt.
That's pretty funny, actually. That's pretty funny. As an added, I love it.
Your last three starts for Shug McGee were on the dirt here, which does make you laugh, you know, really.
It really does. Touch on, I mentioned the first time North America. Let's start in terms of opponents. Let's go there. What do we know about this Ask Paddington for Kerry Breon that makes a North American debut here?
Yeah, to me, he's the X factor in the race, or the question mark. We don't know. We obviously haven't seen him. How good is he? He's won four in a row. He's obviously in very good form. The last was, you know, middle of July, so he's in very good form for him. Those were handicap hurdles, not necessarily the toughest spots in England, but he was handicapped at a 130-ish level, and then he ran poorly in soft ground over the winter, and then got back on good ground and obviously reeled off four in a row. I looking at it more carefully, it's interesting to see his races, like, because those four were kind of longer, you know, 2.5, 2.75 type long races. I don't know if that form sets him up for a race, you know, that would set him up more for a race like the Grand National at Far Hills in terms of trip and hills and being a stayer. And it's sort of his his the way he ran was, you know, being held up toward the back and making a run. And again, I think he would want to be closer. They'll be going faster in front of him today than they've probably ever gone races in England early. So he'd be the concern to me. And I think he gets I probably would have made him second choice or my second if I were the handicapping the race in terms of weights. I might have put him second, you know, just because he does look like he's coming into it in he's at the top of his game. If you're ever going to take on a horse like Snap Decision, you want your horse to be, you know, in as good a form as he could be in. Kerry said he seems to have shipped over fine. He's been training with the Mean Queen, whatever that means. I think he's fairly live, yeah.
Ask Paddington is who we're talking about, and this one, an 8-year-old, and it should be noted that Kerry Breon's record, first North America, this is coming into today, she's 7-for-10 with first-time North American runners with a $3.60 ROI, which is a little scary.
With him that might be a little different is than some of her horses are. I mean, she buys a lot of very lightly raced or unraced horses over there, where this horse has run a lot over there, you know, and it's just a little different scenario for her bringing a horse over. You know, she said they kind of approached her, and she put a deal together for an owner, you know, and it wasn't like she was shopping for him and found him. Coincidentally, she does train the horse's half-brother, who was a maiden that was in her barn last year, which is kind of interesting. I think he's it's very interesting. I'd be more thinking, whoa, here's a horse who might be able to look Snap Decision in the eye if his running style over there was maybe in the 2-mile hurdles or 2 1/8 mile hurdle races as opposed to the 2.5, 2 3/4, 2 7/8 over there.
Ask Paddington, added to the North American scene. Yeah. Then the rest, a lot of familiar players. Iranistan in here, and Cyril Murphy brings back Belfast Banter. Big price. How about Song for Someone? Second North America for Leslie Young. Redissian for Leslie, who won the Sims early in the year and has been part of what has been just an outstanding. We talked to Leslie at the end of Saratoga. So delighted to celebrate the success that her stables had. She's won 24 races in 93 starts this year. Just outstanding. And Cyril Murphy also brings back Mr. Naylor's Amshell out of the Iroquois placement. Nice, solid type as well. So the William Entenmann, and does everybody that come through the gates, does everybody, courtesy of Steeplechase, do they get some chocolate-covered donuts, some Entenmann's?
Three raspberry twists for everybody? Yeah, that's right.
We should do that. They should do that on Entenmann Day.
They should do that. Yeah, yeah. And Mr. Entenmann was a great sportsman, obviously. He owned a bunch of horses with Jonathan Shepherd, Timber Bay Farm, and, you know, was a long supporter of the team, I think, for sure.
Joe Clancy, everybody, this is horseracing.com. The Saratoga special season is over. And actually, Joe, because I talked to the last couple of visits at the end of the season, were with Tom and with Sean. Any final coda to put on the season?
I'm glad it's over, but I'm also sad it's over, like probably everybody else, right? It's nice to get home and sort of get back to normal. It's obviously the bigger Chad Brown and Todd Fletcher win a lot of races. I thought this year it was nice to see some sort of things get spread out a little bit when guys like Phil Bauer have really good meets and Dave Don and Phil Serkey win a great one and close the weekend. Just some stuff like that made for good stuff and to me, you know, shows that Saratoga level horses can kind of, you know, be anybody's barn, and that's why we like it.
This is horseracing.com. We'll continue the Saratoga special type coverage, of course, through the fall, and things somewhat become steeplechase times a little bit here in September and October at This Is Horse Racing. But, Joe, I appreciate it, and you'll be on shortly with Andy for Talking Horses. And the action starts, Belmont at the Big A, with the Entenmann and the Lonesome Glory, a chance to see the two biggest stars, not just North America's biggest jump stars. These two are as big a pair of steeplechase absolute glitterati as there is anywhere in the world. Snap Decision and the Mean Queen treating everybody today at 1 o'clock and 1:32. Joe, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Joe Clancy, everybody. And you follow Joe on Twitter if you don't already. Joe Clancy 65, Saratoga TL, Tom Law, and by Sean Clancy. Our Thursday get-together, and it was perfect timing today when it comes to this unique circumstance with the two jump races coming together here to start the Belmont/Aqueduct fall season. We got about 40 minutes plus, 42, 43, and Dave Hill is going to join us next. And if you saw my tweet just now and Dave's tweet from earlier this morning when his extensive column, I mean, the work that Dave is putting into this, which is not surprising because he is absolutely, I mean, as serious when it comes to approaching any topic as any writer could possibly be. So if you missed week one, pull up the column that just went up at NewYorkTimes.com and NYTimes.com. And Dave went 9-7 overall for week one. But for our purposes, for what you care about, the four games that he gave out on Friday, he was 3-1. So off to an outstanding start. And it was an unusual, it was certainly a crazy opening week. And I actually watched a lot more NFL than I expected to on Sunday because I ended up in a, when I got to Nicholasville, I went, there's a cute little sports bar, the Scoreboard, I think it's called, and they had that, I don't have a DirecTV at home. I had it maybe one year when I first moved to Greenwich. I got a dish, and I didn't care for it, so I ended up moving over to cable. But I watched that Red Zone, and now I know why everybody is so crazy about this Red Zone coverage, where they go from game to game to game to game, and what a weekend it was to go from game to game to game, because it was some of the craziest. It was some of the craziest action I really in memory, and in fact, any game that was angling toward 2020 was absolutely in danger of going to overtime. It seemed right. Even the Giants looked like they were headed to 2020 in overtime, and then it went in a different direction. And Dave Hill was basically forced to look at every direction in his recap and pull up nytimes.com. Dave is going to tell you what we learned from week one and then hitting all the highlights. And he joins us now. Dave, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Excellent. Well done. Great start.
Yeah, man. I'm good at flipping those coins, huh?
Well, I'm sure because of the way you approach things, you probably went back through and tried to see, you know, if some of these games that literally hung in the balance. I mean, obviously the Steeler-Bengal game was insane. I mean, just ridiculous. And you know, then you had the Giant game and the Falcon-Saint game. I mean, there were some games that really teetered. I mean, what was your potential upside and what was your potential downside before settling on 9-7?
No, I think that I was in all those close games. I had the dog, so I wasn't sweating at all. You know what I mean? Like I had the point, so I was in good shape on all those games. The one that killed me was the Giants coming back on the Titans because I laid the points there. So that was the one comeback that really bit me. But in all those comebacks, I was sitting pretty. I felt like there was little chance of me missing. I felt bad for some of those underdogs who looked like they were going to win outright, the Falcons. Yeah, I thought that it was a heartbreaker for some of those teams. The Lions coming back, I was hoping, just I was kind of rooting for the Lions to win there, but I took four, so I knew I'd be okay. So that was a great kind of backdoor cover for me. But that's what the Lions did all last season, too. You know, the Lions are an interesting team because they can't figure out how to win, but, man, they cover the spread. They covered the spread 10 times last season, and they're off to a good start now, you know, losing the game but covering. So, I didn't have too much of a sweat. I just thought that it was fun to watch some of these late-game comebacks. You know, there's a lot of drama. I think there were four or maybe five games that came down to the final minute, the final play. There were five outright upsets. And the craziest number was there were 14 missed field goals. So I don't know what's going on with kickers in the NFL this season, but there was a lot of doinks.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because you did have some weather that potentially, I guess, could have involved. And actually, I don't think in Chicago, right? Did that come into play at all?
Chicago up one. You know, that was one of the big upsets of the day. So you got to reckon that the insane amount of rain impacted that game. I mean, it's hard to know there, and I think that's one of the things people are looking at this week, because Trey Lance was, there was a lot of high hopes for him going into that game, and he didn't play so well. But he has an excuse because they were playing in a monsoon on a field that looked like a swimming pool. So, you know, I think people are saying, let's take another look at him this week. Nobody's really ready to sound the alarm about Trey Lance there yet. But I also think that makes this game this week that much more interesting, given that, we have at least a hint that Trey Lance may not be all that people were hoping he would be, at least not in the early part of the season.
Who, for our purposes moving into week two, let's talk a little bit about the way you open this week's extensive coverage, and that is what we learned, essentially. And, I mean, who impressed you? When you went and looked back, exceeded some expectation that people might still not necessarily latch on to quickly enough? And then who also was surprising in the other direction? I mean, I keep seeing analysts talking about how the Giants may actually be, you know, more than competent. The Jets, of course, less than competent. there are certain things you seem to be able to count on. But give us some early reads and how it's influencing your thoughts going into week two.
Well, one person that I was really impressed with, or one team I was impressed with, was the Ravens. One of the knocks that came out of, one of the sort of takes coming out of week one on the Ravens was that they weren't running the ball like people expect them to. But I kind of think that's a plus, not a minus. I mean, you know, Lamar Jackson's always been known as a running quarterback and the Ravens as a rushing team. So he had a big passing game and they won. And I think Lamar's in a big, I don't know if you followed, but he's in a big contract year this year. He's negotiating it himself. He's got a lot on the line. You know, he set a deadline to re-up his deal with the Ravens, and that deadline passed. So he's playing right now without a guarantee for what happens after the season. So he's got a lot on the line, and I think him having a big passing game was a good thing. He's showing off his arm. He's showing, hey, I'm multidimensional, and it worked. You know, I think this week against the Dolphins, we'll see more yards on the ground than we did last time, but it's good to know that he, you know, is willing to throw it long. I think that the Chiefs impressed me. You know, they look beautiful. I think that they, I've got a Super Bowl future bet on them. I think that they're, you know, they have a great shot to go all the way. And I think the Cowboys look terrible. They look like one of the worst teams in the NFL, which I think everybody was very surprised by, how bad they looked last week. The Buccaneers did something different. They had, Brady handed the ball off a lot to Fournette, and I thought that was pretty cool to see them getting yards on the ground. So that's another game where kind of the inverse of the Lamar Jackson situation, where Brady's showing that he can hand it off and that team, if they need to, can punch it through the middle.
One thing, I'm just looking through what we went over last week, too, and I'm adding up those home dogs that we talked about, and it looks like they basically split, right? Seattle,
yeah.
And of course, right? Seattle, Houston, Detroit, and Atlanta. So four home dog winners. The Rams were a home dog loser. The Jets were a home dog loser. Arizona, a home dog loser, and Dallas, a home dog loser. So 4-4 on the on the home dogs.
Yes, and you know the other thing that I looked at last week was the closing line value on the picks that I made. You know, the closing line value is like, did you get a number that's better than the number where the number closed? And I split that too. You know, I got a worse number on six games and a better number on six, and it held the same on all the rest. So this week it looks like already the screen is popping from when I put in my picks, and it feels like I'm going to do better this week in terms of getting closing line value. You know, a lot of professionals, and I'm not a professional by any stretch of the imagination, a lot of professionals say that getting a better number, you know, beating the closing number is better than winning the bet, right? Because over the long run, if the numbers you're betting are better than where they close, you're going to win money over the long run. Rather than being focused on the results of whether you won or lost that individual bet, did you get the best of the number? Because these numbers close pretty good. I mean, this is a very efficient market. We talked about that a little bit last week. You know, these numbers close pretty close to where they need to be. And if you're beating that number, then you're getting the best of it. And, you know, this is sort of a concept we know in horse racing, too, where we think that, you know, where we look for overlays and, you know, we try to get the better number on the tote board than what we think the horse should be. You know, it's the same way in football. I think if you can get a better number than where it's going to close, then if you're beating that efficient market, then you're going to be in good shape long term. So I'm paying attention to that this season too. I want to try to make bets early and get the best of the number.
And I was absolutely going to follow up that direction you were headed by making the race, you know, the horse race analogy, the same exact thing, exactly right. And you know, if you get to you know, a certain point, and basically luck determines you know, a certain percentage of your plays, and you know, you're going to lose photos. I'll point to my Saratoga where I handicap like I always do, probably pick the same percentage of winners that I normally do, and cashed less tickets. It was particularly the multi-race variety, and you know, one portion of the season was determined by one, a DQ, and then two, a non-DQ, that you know, either one or both, either one of those go the right way, as far as I'm concerned, and it's a, you know, at least a break-even meet, if not profitable. So it's a very similar mentality that you're, you know, that is this frame of reference, that if you stay the course, you know, it you're going to come out, those roles are going to come out your way ultimately.
Right. I think there's a difference between, you know, having a good bet and having a winning bet aren't always the same thing. You can make a bad bet and win, and you can make a good bet and lose. And I think that, you know, in racing, we know sometimes we'll bet a big long shot because we feel like it's overpriced or, you know, that for what it can do. And we see the horse outrun its odds, but maybe doesn't necessarily win the race, and feel good that we, you know, knew that horse was better than whatever, 20-1, you know. I think it's similar here where, you know, if I can get a number and then the market closes that number, if I can get a, you know, get plus 10 and then the market closes at plus 7, then I know I got the better number than where the market closed. Than if I bet it right at kickoff. So, you know, that's another way to sort of evaluate how you're doing in the short term, because we're only 1 week in here, so I have to sort of think about that as we go through the season. In the NFL, sort of, it's rough because it's a short season. We don't get a lot of data. We don't get a lot of games. If you bet on baseball, you get a lot of games to bet on throughout the season, but in the NFL, you don't.
That's true, and there's also, yeah, there's more ebbs and flow that and baseball's a streaky game. It's, you know,
right.
There's also, though, David, actually, that's a terrific point. You bring up I know the way coaches, when you hear coach speak, and they talk about, at least when there was a 16-game schedule, they talked about the four quarters of the season and going, you know, 3-1, 3-1, you know, 2-2, 3-1, and you know, basically, you know, not looking too far down the road, but you know, compartmentalizing a season. And it, you know, there's certain maxims, it seems, in NFL and NFL betting, which includes things like trap games, where you know, everybody can see it coming. It's like it's like on your Waze, on your phone now, and it says pothole in half a mile. Okay, and you're watching for it, and yet somehow you still hit the thing.
Yeah, because look, there's a lot of variance. I mean, not only is there a short season, they play so few games, but even the way these games sort of play out, I mean, you know, so many games are decided in the NFL by one score. And so that means that luck and variance comes in a lot more in the NFL than it does in other sports. I mean, you know, referees' calls have more of an impact. You know, one blown play can have more of an impact than it does in a game like the NBA, or even in a game like college football, where a lot of times scores will be more lopsided than they are in the NFL. So this is really tough for teams, you know, and this is why in the NFL you see teams win Super Bowls and teams not even make it very far in the playoffs, even though, you know, a team can just completely, you know, own the regular season and then some get unlucky in one game in the single elimination playoff and they don't win the Super Bowl, versus like the NBA where you get these seven-game series that hopefully smooths some of the variance out and allows the best team to advance.
Before we talk about this week, let's also, I'm just looking at my notes with you from last week and the betting line sheet that I printed out. One thing we didn't bring up here is the scoring and the over-unders. What did we notice about the point side of things?
Well, I didn't bet any totals. I wasn't really paying attention to how they came out on week one because I didn't bet any. I did sort of notice anecdotally last week that it looked like there was some real low hold and negative hold totals early in the week. You know, looking at the board this week, it looks like the Lions-Commanders game has a negative hold total. That number's at, it's painted anywhere from 48.5 to 47.5 across the board. So you could get a middle there if you wanted. If you grabbed it now, you could probably middle that game for a little bit of money. But yeah, I'm not, I haven't been paying much attention or playing the totals. I think the totals are interesting to me where they correlate to the spread, right? Like
yes.
There's this game this week that we'll talk about in a second where it's a low total. So I think that means that the market thinks there won't be a lot of scoring. So then you can look at the spread and say, you know, well, how does that make me think about the point spread here?
Exactly. And the place I do that, I think, personally, most often is with the Super Bowl. It's always the first thing that I kind of look at. And you know, when I want to get an instant read on what, you know, what Vegas's first, you know, first initial thought is about how, you know, how it's going to go out. But there's no reason why that, you know, that same approach can't be used, you know, week after week.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because my podcast just started this week. It just premiered yesterday. And next week's episode is about the Super Bowl and Super Bowl prop betting. And the guys that I hang out with in that episode kind of do exactly what you're describing. They start with the total and the spread as sort of a market indicator of what the game script will be, and then they build out their model from there, and they try to make predictions on individual game player props, assuming that the market's sense of the total and the spread is right.
Well, let's see if we can't make it right again this week. 3-1 for David, for all of you last week, and only those embarrassing Cowboys, and there's nothing Eagle fans enjoy more than that delicious treat on Sunday night, and there isn't an Eagle fan alive that isn't laughing along with me. Vikings, Chargers, and Seahawks, though, for David, 3-1 last week. And I suppose we have to talk about tonight, right? I mean, this should be pretty entertaining, Chargers coming into Arrowhead.
Yeah, it's going to be a good game. It's a big quarterback battle here between, you know, Patrick Mahomes and a guy who a lot of people think could be the MVP this season. I mean, we'll see how the season plays out for Herbert, but Justin Herbert's he's just a phenomenal talent. So I think we'll see a lot of high flying offense in this game. The total right now in that game is 54. And I think that's the highest on the board, right? Yeah. So that's the highest total on the week on that game. So obviously people are thinking that's going to be a high scoring affair. It probably will be. The Chiefs are 4-point favorites. I think they cover that spread. So I think that the Chiefs are the bet. I didn't take the Chiefs last week, and I paid a price for it. I thought that the Cardinals were getting too many points against them. I was wrong. I think that was a surprise even to the market that was such a big blowout. But this game, I think the Chiefs will handle 4, but I don't think it'll be a blowout like it was against the Cardinals. You know, I think that this could be a game that comes down to a touchdown. But I'm happy to lay 4. I don't think that the Chargers keep it closer than that. So the Chiefs, bet the Chiefs. I'm not going to make that mistake twice.
Well, the 8:15, and I did not get a chance last week to watch the Bills game. And actually, I'm just realizing I'm supposed to go to Lexington. Was invited to a party this evening, and which I could not say no to. So, I guess I'll listen on the radio on the drive back from Lex to
the Bill. I got back to school night tonight, so I'll be that parent at back to school night who's looking at his phone in his pocket.
I love it. Well, and I'm sure for Mr. and Mrs. Hill, those school conferences with your brood, with your wacky, it's almost like a TV family. There must be some interesting conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I hope not. I hope that, because an interesting conversation often means that somebody, you know, that I just wrote this magazine story about the ball kids at the U.S. Open, and I went to the ball kid tryouts at the U.S. Open, and the coaches for the ball kids say, if anybody notices you, you screwed up. Your job is to not be noticed, and sometimes I think it's probably good parenting. It's probably a good thing to say to my kids, too.
Wait a minute, we got to put the NFL on hold for a second with the U.S. Open having just ended. Where is this piece?
It's in Victory Journal, and it hasn't come out yet. It's because that journal doesn't come out monthly, but in the next issue of Victory Journal, I wrote an essay to accompany a really beautiful, really gorgeous photo spread of ball crews all around the country. Including the U.S. Open. And I went to the tryouts, the U.S. Open tryouts for the ball crew there, and watched the kids try out for a spot on the team.
Only here and only with you do we even discover that there are tryouts for the ball boy and girl team. This is hysterical to me. There's actual tryouts? Are they paid? Are these kids paid?
The U.S. Open is the only major that pays their ball crew. Yeah, they pay them $15 an hour here in New York. Nobody else pays, and everywhere else it's a volunteer position, and kids just do it so they can be close to tennis players. But in Queens, they get $15 an hour.
And how old are these kids?
They range from 13 all the way up to adults sometimes do it. Rarely, but sometimes. You know, there's this famous episode of Seinfeld where Kramer goes and tries out to be a ball boy and gets on. But that's actually happened. You know, there are plenty of examples of adults who have done it, but it's mostly kids. And yeah, 14, I think, is generally assumed to be the right minimum age for doing it. They do it all the way into their 20s. I mean, and sometimes longer. People get really into it.
Is there, I mean, is there a Babe Ruth of ball boys or girls?
Maybe Roger Federer. You know, he's probably the most famous tennis player who was a ball boy. And because he was a ball boy when he was young, he kind of has a lot of love for the ball crews. He takes them all, after his events, he takes them out for pizza. Sometimes he buys gifts for all the ball kids. He's very tender with them all. You know, some players have a reputation for being very vicious or, you know, taking a lot of frustration out on the ball kids, but not Roger Federer.
Well, and isn't it apropos that this conversation comes up the morning that Federer retires from the all-time great career?
I mean, yeah, absolute all-time great career. But again, one that started out with him, you know, chasing down stray balls on the court for other players. Yeah,
too funny. Well, Victory Journal, will this appear online or is it strictly something?
I don't know.
I hope print?
Some. I don't know if they're going to use it online. They may. Hopefully, it will be. But it may just be in print.
Unbelievable.
Sometimes they like to keep some goodies, in the magazine that they don't put on the web. But we'll see.
All right, the Chiefs giving four tonight at home in Lee's Summit. And we turn to the Sunday action. Dave, where are we headed? It's a pretty fun matchup weekend. There's some teams that both won. You mentioned the Ravens earlier. The Dolphins show up in Baltimore. You've got a couple of teams that lost as well that are going to face off, like Cincy and Dallas, both teams that had expectations. Vegas and Cardinals looking for first wins. Got the big marquee matchup on Monday night with the Eagles and the Vikings that should be terrific in the blink.
Yeah, we get a doubleheader on Monday night too, which will be fun.
That's right.
Look, one of the problems here with filing my picks on Tuesdays on Wednesday morning is that by the time the paper runs, the numbers have all moved, and so one of the things I really don't want to give your listeners here is a number that they can't get anymore, right? Because what's the point of saying I like, Seattle plus 10 if you can't get plus 10 anywhere? So I was trying to look and see what was still available or what might have moved even in a better direction to see what I could give out. Because I do have some picks that I feel good about, but I just think they're not available. The fact that they're not available just makes me feel even better, right? The fact that the number's moving in my direction makes me feel great about it. But look, I mean, one of those examples of where the number is moving, not in my, moving away from me, but I would still probably take is the Cowboys. I picked the Cowboys plus 8.5. You can't get plus 8.5 anywhere anymore right now. It looks like it's 7 everywhere. So there's obviously some market support at 8.5 where I was at, and that makes me feel good. Whether or not 7 is enough, I don't know, but I'd probably still take it just because I think that a lot of this number, the Cowboys look terrible, but, you know, Dak Prescott looked terrible. And the thing is, Cooper Rush is inexperienced, but, you know, it's kind of like betting on, it's kind of like on in a maiden special way where, you know, if a horse is unraced, then the horse is unknown. You might have a world beater underneath you there, right? So Cooper Rush started one game last season, and it was an amazing game, where they came back and won as underdogs against the Vikings, and he played an awesome game. So I'm kind of looking at Cooper Rush here and with the Cowboys as like a very lightly raced maiden up against a lifetime loser maiden here, which is not fair to the Bengals. They had a great season last season, but Joe Burrow just looked so bad. So I think the Bengals win this game. I don't want to get too out of line here, but I thought, you know, taking points with the Cowboys is probably smart in that particular game. And if you can get a good price, you know, taking the Cowboys on the money line might be a fun bet. I think you should look for something close to plus 300. I wouldn't take anything less than – I wouldn't take anything that was under, you know, plus 245 or – I mean, plus 250. But I think you can find right now 285 is what I got. There's a 293 right now on the board. I think that's a fun bet. But, yeah, so I'm still picking the Cowboys. I'll probably eat these words. Cooper Rush may show up and choke under the bright light, but we'll see. That's my pick there. Another game that I like is I like the Bucks against the Saints, but this is a This is one that comes with a caveat because the injury list looks the injury list from yesterday was not good for the Bucks. There were a lot of people that didn't play, but we'll see today whether they're did not practice. But I'm worried about Julio Jones. We want to see today whether Julio Jones takes the field for practice or is on the injury list. That would make a difference there. But the line I've got there, well, look, it might be moving right as we speak. I think I picked the Bucks minus 2.5. And
That's what I'm looking at.
Yeah, it's 2.5 everywhere. It's 2.5 still. So you can still get 2.5 on them. But I'd wait until the end of the day and see if it's still there, and also to know how this injury list looks for the Bucks. But I think they can definitely cover 2.5 right now if everybody's healthy and ready to go. The Panthers and the Giants, you can still get my number there. And I think that's a good game because I think these two teams are going to play close. They both had very similar games last week to what they'll be up against this week. And I wrote this up in my piece today. But the if you look at it, the Giants in their game last week, they outrushed the Titans, but the Titans beat them in the air, and the Panthers beat the Browns in the air, but got beat on the ground. So we may see a very similar game here where the Giants are going to be the rushing team, and Baker's going to throw some passes, and we may get another very, very close game that comes down to a single score. So in a game like that, I'm taking the points. My heart, I'm rooting for the Giants, but I feel like it's probably good to take the 2.5 here. And it's still 2.5 everywhere. Well, no, it's moving to 2. Yeah, you can still get 2.5 at a couple of shops, but yeah, it's already moved to 2 just this morning. FanDuel's got it at 1.5. So I wouldn't take that. But if you can find 2.5, that's my pick.
Nice. Panthers.
Panthers, Bucks, Cowboys, and Ravens is still there. And I, like I said earlier, I was really impressed with the Ravens. I mean, the Dolphins had a great game too, but I'm expecting a lot from this team this year, and I think that they're going to cover 3.5. So that's my other pick there is the Ravens.
Ravens minus 3.5 against the Fins.
Against the Dolphins, yeah.
So that's a lot of the early action. So you're pretty much you're concentrating on Sunday. And any prime time thoughts? We'll use these 5 as your barometer. But any of the prime time Sunday night, Monday.
The Sunday night game is the Bears Packers, who are big time rivals. But, the line there is 10. And I think I took in the column, I laid 9.5, and the line has moved to 10. So do I want to lay 10 in that game? I think that even laying 9.5 was tough for me because I told you last week I've been using the SEP body power ratings, and those ratings make the Packers 5-point winners here. So already I was going out on a limb and going against the ratings by laying 9.5. So do I want to lay 10? I don't think so. But I didn't want to pick that game either because the numbers already moved from where I was sort of tentatively taking it. But this was me playing a hunch and not playing the data here and thinking that, like we talked about earlier, that the Bears benefited from the weather, that the Packers might be stung from having their bell rung, and that happened to them last season. They got blown out in their first game and came back and crushed in the second. So I was a little bit reticent to take the points here, but as the line continues to move, I may take another look at that one and may want to take the points. But on Monday night, the Vikings-Eagles game, I'm taking the points with the Vikings there again. I took 2.5. The line's already moved to 2. In some places, it's 1. So that line's moving away from me. But, at 2.5, I like the Vikings, if you can find it. I might still take them at 2. I think, this is another one where I might even bet the Vikings on the money line. I thought I was very impressed with them last week. Jalen Hurts looked good. But I think what I said in my write-up was that, the Eagles allowed 35 points from the Lions. So this Minnesota offense, they're going to, you know, how many points are they going to get to put up against a defense that lets the Eagles score 35? You know what I mean? So I don't know. Monday night, I'm looking at the Vikings. I didn't want to give it out because the numbers moved from where I picked it. But the money line doesn't look great. It's like plus 115, 110 everywhere. It should be more like plus 125, I think. So I'd stay away from that. But, yeah, that game's another one with a high total of 50. 50, 50 and a half, 51 in different places. So we're going to see a lot of scoring there. I think the Vikings win that shootout. But the market thinks that, too. It's very close. You know, like I said, it's 1 and 2 in some shops. So I wanted to get as many points as I could there. And so if you can find 2.5, go get it. But it looks like that's maybe that is not going to happen. It looks like the line is there's just too much money coming in on the Vikings.
On the other Monday night game, I want to just ask about one of those mojo and sort of trap scenarios. People are going to look at this Bills team and the blowout win in against the Rams, and here they come home to, you know, to Orchard Park, and here are the Titans after a disastrous loss. And the immediate thought is going to be, oh, the Bills, you know, the Bills will steamroll them. A lot of times, to me, this is one of those trap scenarios in the NFL.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I took, you know, in the column I'm taking the points, I took 10 points with the Titans. I don't feel great about it, but I do think that the Titans, you know, for three quarters looked awesome, you know, against the Giants. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you just get, you get snake bit, and it gets away from you. And I think that in that game against the Giants, once it started, it was like they were watching a movie. You know, it was like they were sort of watching it happen. There's nothing they could do. I think they bounced back from that, but I don't think they beat the Bills. I just felt like 10 points seemed like a lot of points to give that team, and also the power ratings that I was using says that Buffalo should win by a touchdown. So, you know, felt like I got a little bit extra cushion there to take the 10 points. But I don't feel great about it because it is the Buffalo Bills, and they did look awesome. So, you know, if I have to pick the game, I'm taking the bet on them. No, I'm not.
Well, and you know, and remind everybody too, Dave, because you mentioned the data-driven scenario, and you explained it in the opening column last week. And in fact, I took that screenshot. I'm sure you saw the tracking website, the data website. Remind me on that one.
It's unabated. I use unabated.com. There's a number of different sort of odd screens that are available these days. You know, in the old days, people that bet on sports really had only one option, and that was Don Best. And so professional, you know, sports bettors had to spend a lot of money to subscribe to Don Best, and that's how they would be able to see the line movement at books all around the world. Today there's multiple options for people. You know, I use Unabated, and I think that the benefit to having an odd screen is like, I mean, you know, if you know every sport, you know, every sports book is different. They're not all the same. And some are what we call market making books who sort of create the market by going first with their number and, you know, having an opinion on a game that the other books will react to. Right. And so for different sports, different books have the reputation of being the market makers there. And so, you know, when you have an odd screen, you can kind of look at the book that you know is the market maker and then watch the other books react to that. And you can try to find a good price relative to who you think the sharpest book is for that sport. You know, it's a little bit moot in the NFL because the NFL is just such an accurate market. But there are books that use sort of price discovery to come up with their numbers rather than just copying everybody else. And so, you know, odd screen is getting, learning to use an odd screen is kind of a helpful tool. And so, I use Unabated for that. Also, this, you know, the power, there are a number of different power rankings that are available to people, and Unabated has simulator tools that you can use to simulate seasons using those power rankings. They also provide their subscribers with the Massey Peabody rankings every week. which is what I've been using, and I, you know, have a lot of respect for Rufus Peabody, so that's what I've been sort of leaning on, or I plan to lean on this season, is the Massey Peabody numbers. And again, if I can plug my podcast, you know, Gamblers on, from the Ringer, it's next Wednesday. I'm doing a two-part episode on Rufus Peabody, and people can listen and hear all about how he approaches handicapping in his work, and they can see how impressive he is, and maybe that'll drive them. He's a part owner of Unabated. That may drive them towards wanting to use some of those tools he's invented too, because he's a very successful sports bettor.
Well, you find Gamblers on Spotify, and whether you listen to the new and current editions that that Dave always fascinating and interesting, and you know, finding topics that where no one else would. You know, these obviously are popular, you know, gambling, but you've done so many. You know, so many nooks and crannies, and people should go through the, you know, the entire body of work. You'll be entertained and educated too. You know, I tweeted them as part of the follow up day from last week, and they were delighted. I could tell, and it feels like they are underexposed. This Unabated, it looks like they're just an absolute data gold mine. And I equated it to Scotty McKeever's Equine Edge, which has the same basic algorithmic concept. So people that are already familiar with this data driven approach when it comes to racing, it feels like you could step right in, and they've got baseball information, basketball, etc. But the NFL certainly an ideal area for this kind of approach.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Equinedge too, and Scotty and the stuff that he's doing there. I think that, you know, one of the major differences here between these two tools is that, you know, Scotty's got a lot of algorithms kind of behind the scenes in the guts of Equinedge that's doing some work to make your job easier as a handicapper. What's cool about some of the tools that are available Unabated is that you're still, you know, the tools are there, but you get to plug in your own opinions. You get to plug in your own, you know, you can kind of tweak them. Any handicapper can use it. It doesn't do the work for you. And I think that's what I'm trying to do. I think that's what any gambler's trying to do, is how to learn. We need to learn how to be better at doing this for ourselves rather than just, you know, paying people to give us picks or do the work for us. I don't take any, you know, to me, gambling is about playing a game. It's not just about winning money. I want to win a game. So I want to feel like I had something to do with it. You know, I want to feel like I did something. So, so I like tools that help me get better at making my own picks or figuring out the puzzle for myself, rather than, as opposed to tools that just say, here's what we think is going to win, now go bet this.
David Hill, everybody, and always a treat. And we're going to talk to David every Thursday on Twitter, of course, Dave Hill 77, the author of The Vapors. You can go to David Hill online, and all of Dave's work is reachable through that portal. Gamblers on Spotify. The Chiefs, the Cowboys, the Bucks, the Panthers, the Ravens are the five plays today after last week's 3-1 effort. And of course, in the pages of the paper of record, the New York Times. David, thank you. Good luck this week.
Good luck, Steve. Good luck, everybody.
Dave Hill, folks, what a great way to wrap up this first morning at Churchill Downs. Racing later this afternoon. I'm going to work on late pick five for you. And I won't be on track today. We'll save that for the weekend, but headed over to Lexington tonight. Want to thank Tom Rapps, who won the King of Kentucky Downs Turf Challenge. KK right here, Horse Racing KK, everybody. Jason Milligan, and we got in the nice Oaklawn sort of promotional to get you to take advantage of the trainer bonus. Get a stall or eight from Pat Pope. PMAC joined us opening day at Aqueduct. for Belmont season, and Joe Clancy as well, and David Hill. Thanks, everybody. Good luck this afternoon and this evening. I will talk to you weekend preview at the races here at Churchill Downs tomorrow. Talk to you then.
It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
The Southern California Thoroughbred Racing Circuit returns to Los Alamitos with opening day set for fun.
Get the action in thorough horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org to